Some of you may have heard these words earlier this week. They said, time will heal. But Lord, it's a fortnight now, and it hasn't healed at all. They said, don't look back, look forward. But Lord, how can you look forward when there's nothing to look forward to? That's part of the prayer that was spoken by the Reverend Alan Swinton, chaplain of the Aberdeen Royal Infirmary, at the memorial service on Wednesday this week for the 167 victims of that disaster on the Piper Alpha North Sea oil rig. It was a remarkable prayer. Those of you who heard it, I'm sure, will feel you agree with me in that. One could almost call it unprecedented for such a public, such a national occasion. It was 600 words long, for a start. It was also extemporary in style. Without platitudes or formality, the Reverend Swinton, in effect, in that prayer, conducted a brutally frank conversation with God on behalf of the 1,600 bereaved next of kin who were gathered in front of him in the Kirk of St. Nicholas. He told God what they had suffered. With unrepressed candor, he ventilated their complaint against a cruel providence that had robbed them of their loved ones. According to newspaper reports, the majority of those present, both inside the church and the 1,000 or so gathered outside, were released into tears before he'd finished his prayer. I don't know, perhaps he'd been reading the book of Job before he entered the pulpit to lead that prayer that day. Certainly, you could argue Job is the book of the Bible written for meditation on such occasions. It's the book which, more than any other, seeks to address the vexed problem of human suffering. And there's no question that Job's method of seeking a solution to that problem, like the Reverend Swinton's, involves giving public and candid voice to the indignation and the bewilderment he feels that God's dealings with him. So perhaps it's appropriate that in a week when we have been forced to think about such a major disaster, we're studying this book. If you open it, I think you'll quickly see, just by glancing through its pages, that it's comprised of four sections. First, in chapters 1 and 2, there's a prose prologue, which outlines the series of catastrophes that befell Job. First, losing all his property, then his family, finally his health. Then from chapter 3, right through the main bulk of the book, there's a long poetic discourse. You can see it's poetry in the NIV from the way it's arranged on the page. This long section of poetry involves several cycles of speeches by Job and various of his friends. In it, he gives vent to those complaints of his. Then, in chapter 38 through to chapter 41, we reach the climax of the book. For in those chapters, God replies to Job out of a tempest. And then finally, in chapter 42, there's a short epilogue, once again in prose, which recounts the restoration of Job to prosperity once again. Now, this discontinuity of literary style, a prose sandwich of a great deal of poetry, has led many scholars to ask, I think, quite valid questions about how the book was put together. And those of you who make a practice of reading books on the Bible, commentaries and such like, you'll probably be aware of some of the questions that are asked. You see, if you look at the prose sections, say, take chapter 1, just for an example, that strongly suggests a very, very early date. For Job is portrayed in this prose prologue as a wealthy, oriental sheikh living in the patriarchal age, the age of Abraham. Like Abraham, we're told in verse 3, his wealth is measured in animals, of which he had many thousands. Like Abraham again, we're told in verse 5, he made a practice of offering sacrifices as the head of his clan. There was no organized priesthood to perform that function for Job. What's more, if you look at verse 15 of chapter 1, you'll find that just as again in Abraham's day, Job's livelihood was threatened not by the huge empires of Assyria and Babylonia that dominate the history of the later period of the Old Testament, but rather by marauding desert tribes. And what's more, according to the very first verse of chapter 1, you'll find that Job did not live in the defined national boundaries of Israel at all. He lived in the land of Uz, we're told, not Oz, Uz. A territory which in later days would certainly have been regarded as pagan, probably Edomite. But of course in the days of Abraham in the patriarchal age, territory was far less spiritually aligned than that. The knowledge of God was much more widely diffused around the Fertile Crescent. So always round that the social and political scenario depicted in this prose prologue would accord very well with the kind of situation you find when you read the latter chapters of the book of Genesis, for instance. And the same is true of the prose epilogue in chapter 42 at the very end of the book. Two observations I'll just make quickly from there. First of all, in verse 11 of chapter 42, we encounter a unit of silver money. And it's a unit of money which, in fact, we only come across in the Old Testament in the patriarchal period. It doesn't seem to have been known later than that. What's more, we're told in the very last couple of verses of chapter 42 that Job died eventually at the age of 140 years. Well, as you will know, that kind of longevity we normally associate with the patriarchal period, with people who lived in the time of Moses or before. So clearly, the story of Job is set in very early times. Indeed, there are Jewish traditions which ascribe its authorship to Moses. And one tradition even links Job with a man called Jobab, a king of Edom, who's mentioned by name in Genesis chapter 36 as a grandson of Esau. Not an unlikely speculation, perhaps. The trouble is, however, when you examine the central poetic section which this prose, prologue, and epilogue sandwich, it is very hard to believe that this book could have been written down at that very, very early period. I mean, quite apart from the difficulty of actually believing that Job, this tortured man, coming out of his suffering, spoke such perfect poetry off the top of his head. Hard to believe that, isn't it? And that there was somebody there busily taking it down all the time as he wrote it. Quite apart from that, scholars point out when they look at the Hebrew of these central chapters, that they show not just an influence later than the patriarchal period, they detect the influence of Aramaic vocabulary in the book, which very strongly suggests it must have been written in the exilic period or after that. So how was the book put together then? Well, perhaps a rather interesting reference in the book of Ezekiel gives us a clue. In Ezekiel, which of course was written during the exilic period, in chapter 14, we come across a verse which actually mentions Job by name. It doesn't mention the book of Job, but it mentions Job as a character who was clearly well known in Ezekiel's day as a kind of folk hero. His name is linked with another ancient hero, Noah, and indeed with another man less well known, a similar figure of ancient legend. So Job in the exilic period was a kind of Old Testament saint, a man of antiquity, famous for his righteousness and piety. Probably what happened then was that an anonymous poet of that later exilic period decided he would use this popular and familiar story of Job as a vehicle for the discussion of the question of suffering which he wanted to address. And if we're right in that surmise, it's tempting to suggest that the prose introduction and epilogue form the kind of ancient story of Job retold by our unknown author in narrative form, more or less as his contemporaries knew it, the way it had come down in oral tradition. But that in these central chapters, from chapter 3 onwards, we find the original work of this inspired but unknown author as he projects himself back into the experience of this ancient man Job and interprets Job's feeling into what would have been for him modern poetry. Now, I suppose some people might feel a bit threatened by a suggestion that that's how the book of Job came to be written. They might even want to respond that that turns the book of Job into a valueless work of fiction. I think that would be completely to get hold of the wrong end of the stick. See, God has put this book of Job in the Bible. He's put the character of Job in the Bible as the archetype of suffering, human suffering. In every age, in every culture, there's something timeless about Job. What if the words attributed to him were composed 1,000 years after he lived? That doesn't render them valueless, because the experience to which they testify is a universal experience. The sacred author speaks for Job just as authentically as the Reverend Swinton was speaking for those bereaved relatives last Wednesday at the Piper Alpha funeral. Indeed, inspired by the Holy Spirit, I strongly suspect this poet of Job speaks for everybody who suffers, including himself. For it's hard for me to believe that anybody could write words of such tender pathos as we find in Job if he had not himself known personal tragedy of some kind. Any of you who've studied English may well be familiar with John Milton's great poem, Samson Agonistes. Milton wrote that poem drawing on the Old Testament story of Samson, with which he felt affinity, because, of course, Samson, like Milton, was blinded. In the same way, our poet, the poet of Job, is no philosopher coolly detached from this tortured figure of pain that he's presenting to us in his poetry. He can verbalize Job's passion because in some measure, at any rate, he shared his sufferings. That's what makes the book special, I think. And that's why it really is of little consequence whether you treat it as a historical, verbatim account of what really passed between Job and his friends, or as an epic poem like Samson Agonistes, which uses dialogue as a literary device for communicating the feelings and the struggles of an unknown poet 1,000 years later. What matters is that the Holy Spirit has a purpose in this book. He's the author of it. And our task is to identify the purpose of the Holy Spirit in this book and learn why, in the wisdom of God, it's been placed here in the canon of the Old Testament for our learning. Over these next 4 Sundays, we're not going to take the book of Job chapter by chapter. We haven't got time for that, even if it were an appropriate way of studying an epic sort of poem of this sort. What I wanted to do, rather, is to survey these 4 major sections in the book and try and get a broad understanding of it as a whole. So next week, for your anticipation, we're going to look at chapters 4 right through to 37, the whole central section in which Job talks with his friends. And then the week after that, we're going to look at that climactic section, chapters 38 to 42, when Job is encountered by God himself. And then finally, in our 4th study, we'll look at the final chapter and observe what I can only say is the unsatisfying way in which the book ends. Most people, I think, feel the book of Job ends in an unsatisfying way, with him simply getting back all that he'd lost. All the questions that Job asks are left unanswered. And I want us to see how those unanswered questions are actually pointing the way within the whole canon of the Bible towards Jesus. But for today, we're going to limit our study to some preliminary thoughts from the chapters 1 to 3, where the author, as it were, lays down the presupposition or framework for his discussion of the problem of suffering. The things he takes for granted, the basis on the platform of which he's going to build his argument, his discussion. Now, these are the four principles which he, I believe, lays down in these early chapters that we need to get a hold of and have clear in our minds in order to understand the remainder of his book. The first is this, that God is sovereign over human suffering. The second is, there is such a thing as innocent suffering. The third is, that God does not mind us expressing our negative feelings about suffering. And the fourth is that there is a necessary mystery about suffering. All right, let's look first then at God's sovereignty over human suffering. The writer's quite clear about this. Look at chapter 1 again, verses 6 to 12. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with him. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then. Everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Now you see, one very easy solution to the problem of suffering, and one that is indeed adopted by some religions and philosophies, is called dualism. According to dualism, good and evil are equal and opposite powers in the universe. They're locked in perpetual struggle. All the nice things that happen derive from the good force, from God. All the bad things that happen derive from the evil force, from the devil. That sounds extremely plausible, doesn't it? In fact, it's not unusual to find some Christians sliding into that kind of dualistic thought mode sometimes, wanting to distinguish things in their lives which are sent from God and things which are sent from the devil, as if the two were distinguishable. But according to the Bible, it isn't as simple as that. According to the Bible, God is the sole sovereign, in total control of the whole universe. His rule may be opposed by evil forces, but it can't be thwarted by them, it can't be defeated by them. He's the only one who's got omnipotence. And that's why you find, for instance, the book of Isaiah, the prophet saying, put in the words of the Lord, "I am the Lord, there is no other, my purpose will stand, I will do all that I please, I form light, I create darkness, I bring prosperity and disaster, I, the Lord, do all these things." Now, you may say, well, we know there is a devil in the Bible. Where does he fit in there? Well, according to Job, the devil fits in among the angels. That's where we find him here, you see, among the angels coming to address God. A created being, in other words, with no power at all of his own except the power God permits him to have. That comes out very clearly, doesn't it, in the limitation on Job in verse 12. "Very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger," says God. And interestingly, when Satan finds that Job refuses to curse God in spite of all the misery he brings on him, he has to go back to God in chapter 2 a second time to obtain a second mandate in order to extend the boundaries of the trial. Chapter 2, verse 4 and 6. "A man will give all he has for his own life, but stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." from first to last, then, Job's situation is never out of God's control. Never a hint that the power of evil in this universe can usurp God's throne or contradict his omnipotence. So what happens to Job in this book is in a very real sense to be seen as God's will for Job. As Job himself is the first to acknowledge in chapter 1, verse 20. When he hears about the disasters that have befallen his property and his family, Job gets up, tears his robe, shaves his head, falls to the ground in worship and says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave. The Lord has taken away." Again in chapter 2, verse 10. Replying to his wife, who encourages him to curse God and die, "You're talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" So both good and trouble come from God in Job's mind. Dualism just isn't on for the writer of Job. We can't spare God the embarrassment of the problem of suffering by blaming it all on the devil. For the devil, like Pontius Pilate, could have no power at all over any of us except it is given him from above. Now, without any question, that deepens the intellectual problem of suffering, doesn't it? That we can't blame it all on the devil in that naive way. But if you think about it, I think you'll see it at the same time. It's absolutely necessary if we're going to enjoy any kind of reassurance or consolation in the midst of suffering. Time and time again, you find when you're trying to help people as they pass through a tragedy, that it is only the conviction that somehow, somewhere, God has a purpose in it all, that God is in control of it all, that it is in some mysterious way God's will that shields us from total despair. I mentioned that great poem by Milton, Samson Agonistes. That's the conclusion to which he brings us. "All is best," he says, "though we oft doubt what the unsearchable dispose of highest wisdom brings about. And ever best is found in the close." You can find the same sentiment in Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a famous German who was executed by the Nazis in the war. In his book, Cost of Discipleship, he writes, "Should it be ours to drain the cup of grieving, even to the dregs of pain, at thy command, we will not falter, thankfully receiving all that is given by thy loving hand." Call it resignation, if you like. Call it fatalism, though I don't like the word. What the writer of Job is convinced of is that we are not adrift in an uncertain world where, for all we know, evil will win. Now, God is in sovereign control over Job's sufferings, over all sufferings. And that is at once both the source of our bewilderment and the source of our comfort. That's his first presupposition, then. God is in control. There's no easy dualistic way out. Secondly, there is such a thing as innocent suffering. Look at chapter 1, verse 8. "Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil.'" Now, among religions that reject the dualistic solution, there is another alternative solution to the problem of suffering, which is very common. And that's the theory of retribution. According to the theory of retribution, all suffering is a direct divine punishment for sin in some way. A classic example that always comes to my mind is that we find in the book of Acts among the primitives on the island of Malta after Paul is shipwrecked there. We're told that the survivors from the wreck, gathering sticks to make a fire on the beach, Paul among them, and as he gather sticks, a serpent, a snake, comes out and bites his hand. Immediately, the unsophisticated Maltese natives put two and two together and make five. "Ah," they say, "this man must be a murderer. He's escaped the sea, but vengeance will not allow him to live." Get the point. He'd done something wrong. The shipwreck nearly got him. having failed in that, Nemesis will pursue him through the snake. Well, it has to be admitted that this view of the matter does come closer to the Bible's perspective, closer anyway than dualism does, because the Bible does see a connection between human suffering and sin. But it's extremely important, I think, to express that connection correctly if you're not to make false deductions from it. Indeed, and here we're coming on to the point our friend raised at the back of why I think it may be important to realize the context, the theological context in which Job was written. I think you can make a good case for saying that one of the major purposes for the poet writing the book of Job was to correct misrepresentations of the theory of retribution, which we know began to become current in the exilic and post-exilic periods. See, the Old Testament often says, if you keep God's law, you will be blessed as a result. Moses in the book of Deuteronomy expresses that on a national level. The society which keeps God's law will be an economically prosperous society, he says. And the book of Proverbs, the primary sort of wisdom book of the Old Testament, the book of Proverbs goes a long way towards affirming that same principle for individuals. You want to be successful in life? Fear God. Keep his commandments, says Solomon, and you will be successful. Conversely, both Deuteronomy and Proverbs assert that both for societies and individuals, when we break God's laws, we make a rod for our own back. If we flout his rules, we'll pay for it, they say. But nowhere in the canon of the Old Testament is that principle of reward and retribution hardened into a universal, inflexible rule, admitting of no exceptions, particularly of no exceptions in the short-term experience of men and women. Those of you who are mathematicians will know there's a well-known logical fallacy that arises when you misuse what mathematicians call a syllogism. I'll give you an example. Cows eat grass. Rabbits eat grass. Therefore, a cow is a rabbit. The fallacy is obvious. But it is exactly the same logical fallacy, you see, as those who might want to argue, sinners are made to suffer. Job was made to suffer. Therefore, Job is a sinner. Not necessarily followed, you see. But almost certainly, there were among the theologians of that post-exilic wisdom school in Israel, people who carried the doctrine of retribution to that illogical extreme. We begin to find evidence of that in books outside the Bible of that period. In fact, it's quite likely, to my mind, that Job's three friends in this book are intended to be caricatures of precisely the kind of philosopher that our author-poet was familiar with in his own day. You can't be sinless, Job, they say. If you were sinless, you wouldn't be suffering. They're blinkered into, you see, this theory of retribution, which they've accepted. For them, all suffering has to be deserved suffering. There's no room in their theology any longer for the phenomenon of innocent suffering. They've lost touch with it. And I would like to suggest to you that Job can be seen, at any rate, as written deliberately to contradict that point of view. The primary presupposition of Job is that there is such a thing as innocent suffering, and you have to cope with it. Indeed, ironically, you see, according to the story, it was precisely because Job was blameless that he suffered. Double irony, it was precisely because Job passed the first test and retained his piety in spite of the loss of all his possessions and children, that he has to suffer even more. That proverb, skin for skin, that we come across in chapter 2, I suspect actually means skin under skin. The devil is saying, Up till now, Job's sufferings have been comparatively superficial. He's not really pious, just thick-skinned, as we say. Cut a bit deeper, and you'll get to the sensitive skin, and he'll start cursing then, all right. You see, once again, the devil's insinuation proves false, doesn't it? Even the incitements of his grief-stricken wife don't shift Job's fundamental conviction about the righteousness of God. In all this, we read, Job did not sin. Whatever else we have in Job, then we have a classic example of a man who didn't deserve to suffer, but who did. So, whatever the Bible teaches us about retribution, it must be expressed in such a way as to make room for the Jobs of this world and the tragedy of their personal experience. Now, once again, that's of enormous pastoral importance. When suffering comes, it's extremely common to hear people say, I don't know what I've done to deserve this. See, that theory of retribution hangs over in our culture, casts a long shadow. Indeed, quite often, after a death in a family, you find a bereaved partner or a bereaved parent tormented with guilt feelings. It was my fault. Well, Job shows us that it may very well not be their fault at all. It's perfectly possible that they may have done nothing to deserve their troubles at all, just as Job had done nothing to deserve his. It's even possible, as in Job's case, that the fact that they're suffering is in fact a commendation rather than a condemnation of them. Now, undoubtedly, the judgment of God ought to be feared. But we mustn't invert the Bible's logic. All sinners will suffer, true. But not all who suffer are sinners. That's the second presupposition, then, of our author. The third is this, that God doesn't mind us expressing our negative feelings about suffering. Just look at the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3. When Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. And then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights, and no one said a word to him, because they saw how great his suffering was. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Now, some commentators, you will read, want to drive a wedge between the Job of the prose prologue, chapters 1 and 2, and the Job we find from chapter 3 onwards. The first Job, they say, is unbelievably self-restrained. He voices no complaints. He's sanctimoniously frigid in his pious resignation to fate. But the Job of chapter 3, they say, is an altogether more warm and believable person who rages against God's injustice in passionate indignation, as we see in chapter 3 when we read it. Now, there may be an element of explanation arising from the way the book was put together. It may be, you see, if we're right in what we were surmising earlier, that the Job of the first two chapters is the idealized Job of Jewish folk tradition, the story of Job as it had been told down through the ages. It may be that it isn't until we get to the central poetic section where the poet identifies himself with Job's inner struggles that we begin to discover a real suffering man, as it were, rather than an idealized figure of history. But I suspect, it has to be said in addition to that, that those who voice this wedge must not drive it too deep. If they do, I think they are simply demonstrating that they've got less insight into the psychology of suffering than the author of the book of Job had. And the fact is, when people are suddenly hit by tragedy, it very often does take a number of days for the shock to wear off. Very often people are at first dazed by what has happened to them. they may appear to be coping extremely well. Oh, she got through the funeral marvelously, we say. The truth is, their minds have just gone into automatic. They haven't really begun to wrestle with the emotional wounds that have been inflicted on them at all. That's why there is, in fact, quite a good deal of counseling wisdom in this Eastern tradition that we see exemplified here at the end of chapter 2, whereby the mourners will simply come and sit with a suffering person for a week, offering nothing but silent company until the person themselves indicates they're ready to start talking. That's quite wise. It's not then necessarily a different Job we encounter in chapter 3, but simply a Job who's passed out of that period of initial shock and numbness into a phase of grieving in which he can begin to wrestle with his savaged feelings. And like the Reverend Swinton, who we mentioned earlier in his prayer, Job does so at times with what you might have thought was outrageous candor. True, he never actually curses God, but he curses pretty well everything else, including, as we saw in chapter 3, his own birthday. "May the day of my birth perish," he says. "If I'd known what you had planned for me, God, I'd rather my birthday were erased from the calendar. I wish the sun had never dawned on it. I wish it had remained buried in permanent and total darkness. Indeed, I'd rather be dead, God. I'd rather have been a stillbirth and never lived, God, than to have to encounter this bitterness." Now, some might want to argue that in expressing his bitterness with that degree of outspokenness, Job has forfeited his claim to being wholly righteous in his response to God amidst all his troubles. Remember what chapter 1 said? "In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing." Or chapter 2, "In all this, Job did not sin in what he said." Well, maybe that was so, you might say, initially. But not once you get beyond chapter 3. The proverbial patience of Job has surely worn a little thin by the time you get to chapter 3. But to understand the book in that way, I think, would be a mistake. And the writer makes us clear that it would be a mistake. Because when we get to the end of Job, we do not hear any divine rebuke regarding these outspoken complaints he's voiced about God's dealings with him. On the contrary, this is what we read in chapter 42, verse 7. "The Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, one of Job's three friends, 'I'm angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has.'" Clearly then, God did not regard Job's bitter words as in any way impugning his innocence. God didn't mind that Job expressed his feelings in this candid way. He doesn't reprimand his suicidal thoughts. He doesn't chasten him for his indignant questionings. On the contrary, God rebukes those friends of his who had told him he was wrong to talk like that. That's whom God rebukes. Isn't that interesting? Now, as far as God is concerned, the way that Job addresses him in this book is the way any righteous man under suffering may be expected to address God. And again, that's enormously important pastorally. See, some of us, dare I say it particularly, some of us Christians are very emotionally inhibited. In particular, we find it very, very hard to ventilate negative feelings when they arise within us. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that when we're children, brought up in strict Christian homes, any time we display our temper, let it be most justly, we're dropped on like a ton of bricks, aren't we? "You mustn't show any temper. That's very wrong. It's very wrong to be angry." And so the thoughts have got entwined in us that anger is sinful. We cannot feel angry without simultaneously feeling guilty about feeling angry. The two emotions are triggered off by one another in us, bound up with one another. And you see, that makes it extremely difficult for us to handle suffering safely, healthily, emotion in our emotions. We don't have a way of ventilating the negative feelings we've got. Instead, they get buried, they get repressed. We don't handle the grief, we run away from it. Again and again, you see in a counseling situation the vital importance of giving people permission to be angry, to feel that what has happened isn't right, that it hurts them, that it wounds them, that they're bitter and resentful about it. That's what the Reverend Swinton so very wisely was seeking to do in his candid prayer before those bereaved families in Aberdeen. He was trying to give them the opportunity to begin the painful business of facing up to their grief, facing up to their negative feelings, expressing them, letting them out in some way, of admitting to themselves, to one another, even to God, for those who believed in him, just how bitter and angry and broken-hearted they were. And you see, the book of Job assures us there is no sin in that. On the contrary, God welcomes such emotional honesty. It is far more precious to him than any amount of sanctimonious cant offered by the Job's comforters of this. That's the third presupposition, then, with which he's working, and which many in his day would have wanted to deny, because, like Job's comforters, they took the view that suffering was a sin, and therefore you ought to feel guilty about resenting it, seeing as you deserved it. But before we leave our first study, one fourth and final presupposition which underlies the book of Job, and which I think we have to try and get a handle on if we're to understand what the author's trying to get at. And that is that there is a necessary mystery about suffering. Look again at chapter 3, verses 11 and 12, and notice there the word which we always use in a situation of suffering. Why? Why didn't I perish at birth? Why were their knees to receive me? Look further down and you'll find he uses it again in verse 20 and in verse 23. In fact, you'll find Job asking why rather a lot in the chapters that lie ahead. It's the question we always ask. We could put up with suffering if we saw there was a reason for it. It's the irrationality of suffering that is so hard to bear, isn't it? Now, one might have thought, since the whole purpose of the book of Job is to help us with the problem of suffering, one might have thought that by the end of the story, some of these tortured questions, some of these tortured whys, would have found an answer. But the fascinating thing about the book of Job is that one looks in vain for any answers at all. These questions, why, are never answered at all. Though he asks them in such desperation, Job never gets an answer to that. No resolution to his fundamental questions. The only answer which the book gives to why Job was suffering is an answer Job himself never discovers. We're told about it right from the beginning in chapter 1. That interaction between Satan and God. Does Job fear God for nothing? Satan asks. Very well then, everything he has is in your hands. But Job never finds out about that heavenly conversation. It takes place in the council chambers of God, out of earshot of earth. And even when God encounters Job personally in chapters 38 to 41 and reveals himself to him in the tempest, God doesn't tell Job anything at all about this transaction in heaven. From first to last, the reason for Job's sufferings are kept secret from him. As far as Job is concerned, it is a mystery. Now, why doesn't the author let Job find out the answer? Why doesn't God reveal it to Job? I mean, think how what a comfort it would be to Job to realize that this is what was going on, that Satan had desired to have a bit of a fling with him to see whether he was a real man of God or not. But in asking why Job is never told that, is never revealed to Job, maybe we're coming close to the heart of the central point this author's trying to get across to us. See, the whole issue raised by Satan hinges on whether it is possible for a human being to serve God without mercenary hope of reward. Remember, there was this strong school of opinion among the philosophers of that author's day, which wanted to urge piety on people as a way of being healthy and wealthy. God always rewards the righteous, he said, he always punishes sinners. It's in your interests to be spiritual, to be pious. But the question which is on this inspired poet's heart is that the only reason people serve God? Is religion just a form of enlightened self-interest? For many in his day were presenting it that way. Now, he's convinced it isn't so. He's sure that authentic religion is not just a contract for blessing. It's a personal relationship with God. That's what authentic religion is. And he sees the experience of innocent suffering, as in Job's case, as the critical test of that kind of authentic religion. All the way through his experiences, you see, no matter how furious Job gets with God, he never loses his fundamental sense of being in God's hands. In fact, if you think about it, the very fact that he speaks to God as candidly, as intimately sometimes as he does in this book, is evidence of the permanence of his relationship with God. If he had seen God merely as some kind of magical blessing dispenser, you know, keep the Ten Commandments, and tomorrow you get a bank rise. If he thought of righteousness just as a form of insurance policy against disaster, why then, as soon as his prosperity left him, Job would have reacted just as his wife reacted. Curse God and die. You don't go on paying insurance premiums once you discover the company don't pay up when you lose. But Job can't do that. Really can't do that. He can be angry with God. He can be disappointed with God. He can be resentful against God. But he can't break with God. Job in this book just goes on and on wrestling with his problem. He never accepts the glib and easy solutions of his friends. But neither does he ever abandon his fundamental belief in the reality of God. It is an insoluble problem for him. It is an inescapable mystery. He can find no way out of it. Yet he clings on. And that, you see, what the author wants us to see in Job. Indeed, by the very structure of the book, that is what God wants Satan to see in Job. That there is such a thing as a personal bond between a human being and his maker, which can stand anything, which can last forever. And for Job, for the writer of Job, the existence of that bond is the clue to the mystery of suffering. Of course, suffering is irrational. Of course, Job never finds out the answers to his questions. If he found out the answers to his whys, it would subvert the whole purpose of the test. It has to be a mystery for Job. It has to remain a mystery for Job. For the righteousness God is looking for is a righteousness of faith. And it's the hallmark of faith that it goes on trusting, goes on praying, goes on hoping, goes on looking for answers, even when there are no answers. Even when it is hanging in total innocence on a cross, crying, "My God, my God,